My short, sweet life as a human target. I could think of nothing to recommend me when Susie asked me to join their senior women's ice hockey team. After all, I'd only skated on figure skates, and that was over 40 years ago, a time when hockey was still resolutely a boys-only sport. Susie explained the team was made up of moms who decided to take up the sport after many hours of chauffeuring their young daughters to remote rinks at pre-dawn hours. Not only did I not fit Susie's demographic as a hockey mom, but additionally, I'd be the only AARP member on the team. Even so, she pressed forward with her sales pitch. "You'll pick it up quickly," she said. "After all, you're athletic." Yes, I'd like to think of myself as athletic, but any such reputation is based on racket sports, and within this narrow field, my expertise is entirely focused on my forehand. Mine is a freakishly blistering stroke, both cross-court and down the line, but the rest of my game is crap. A wildly inconsistent backhand, no-net game, feeble pity-pat serve, and slow, lumbering movements around the court. Apparently, my forehand was enough to get me recruited to an ice hockey team. This compliment prompted me to consider Susie's offer. My tennis learning curve had long since stalled out. To improve at tennis, I would need to move beyond my innate athletic abilities and become a truly committed athlete, willing to invest time, effort, and above all, money for lessons. Perhaps I could quickly ascend the steep learning curve of hockey, since I was athletic. Perhaps the hand-eye coordination on glorious display with my forehand could extrapolate to hockey. Yes, I not only took the bait, I engulfed it, slurped it up in a spasm of pride. I joined the Hot Flashes, a hockey team whose name accurately reflected my estrogen level. My first foray on hockey skates was a sobering experience. I was only familiar with the toe pick of figure skates that propel a skater forward on mincing steps. In contrast, hockey skates require a vigorous side-to-side movement with the edges of the skates digging into the ice. The incompatibility of the two skating movements was vividly demonstrated by my immediate pratfall. Then there was the issue of stopping, requiring a major weight shift, ideally embellished with a spray of ice chips. I could only stop by running into the rink wall. My inability to stop or change directions gave me pause, but then I realized the goalie position doesn't require speed, sharp turns, or skating backwards. I had given up skating backwards given my challenge in moving forward. The team needed a goalie, and even better, the position fit my secret agenda. My husband Nick was a hockey winger in college, and I thought it would be an interesting experience to share a sport. Over the 20 years of marriage, we were both miserable in our attempts to play mixed doubles tennis. Nick was continually disappointed in my play. Like me, he wondered why someone with such a good forehand couldn't hit a backhand. So if we were going to share an interest in hockey, I knew that I had to play a different position, separate but equal. I was pleased to hear Nick say, "I could never play goalie. They're basically human targets. You do realize that people are going to be shooting projectiles at you." The concept of a human target was momentarily disturbing. My only previous experience was as a dodgeball player in grade school, and I loved it. Loved the dodging and weaving, watching the ball harmlessly sail by me, and then taunting the opponents. However, as a hockey goalie, the point was not to get out of the way, but actually get hit and stop the puck. The successful goalie was essentially a fearless human target with bruises to show for it. I relaxed when I thought of the swaddling fat suit of padding that would envelop me. I pointed out to Nick that I'd be far safer as a goalie than a skater flailing and splatting on the ice. Nick had seen me skate and appreciated my logic. From my point of view, things were falling into place. In fact, Nick agreed to be our team coach. At our first practice, Nick lined up a series of pucks in an arc in front of the goal and started taking shots. His strategy was simply to plunk me dead on to demonstrate that a key goalie strategy is just taking up space. As he moved along the arc, he hit the shots with more zip and elevation. The pucks rose from skate level to shin level and finally thigh. Far from taking advantage of the vengeful opportunity before him, he shot at me with a pure and loving heart, tempering his innate enthusiasm in order to simulate the shots that I'd face. I was thrilled to hear a sharp clang when the puck ricocheted off my skate blade, the clunk when the puck hit my stick, and the dull thunk when it hit my pad. As he amped up the velocity, I felt his growing admiration as he realized that his wife was a fearless gamer, someone who would meet him at least halfway in a male-dominated sport. His added bonus was the embellished story he told his tennis team when they grumbled about domestic tribulations. Nick would boast, "Boys, I've got it made. I just go out and shoot pucks at my wife." But the truth was that we agreed the arrangement provided a deep and mutual satisfaction. Nick assessed my game time abilities during the scrimmage at the end of our practice and offered a few basic tips. There are two types of goalies, floppers and stand-up goalies. I'd recommend that you become a stand-up goalie because you are struggling to get back off the ice once you flop. I agreed. A flopping beached whale came to mind, but I kept that horrifying image to myself. If you use your stick and glove more, you won't have to get up and down. Now here's my second suggestion. You've just got to protect your five hole. It's wide open. The five hole? What the hell is that? I thought. I looked down at my equipment and saw no exposed flesh anywhere. He noticed my confusion and realized I needed coaching in standard hockey jargon. He pointed his stick at the four corners of the net. These are the basic targets for a shooter. The four holes are in the corners of the net, and this hole between your skates, well, that's the five hole. He took a stick and clacked it back and forth between my skates. Frankly, the five hole seemed to be the least of my worries. First of all, it was small compared to the other holes and seemed easy enough to block with my stick. "Here's the problem," said Nick. "You flinch when someone shoots a puck at you, and when you flinch, you lift your stick like this." He mimicked my signature move by closing his eyes, turning his head, arching his back, which in turn lifted his stick off the ice. "See, now your five hole is gaping open. Just remember to keep your stick on the ice, and you'll be okay." With that crash course in net minding, off we went to our first game at Johnny's Ice House in Chicago. We gathered in our assigned locker room and started to put our gear on. "Smells like hockey in here," said one of my teammates, commenting on the stale, sweaty odor from the three teams that preceded us. "Don't think I washed my jersey from last year either." As everyone unfurled their rumpled jerseys for a general sniff party, I realized that this was the first time that I had ever experienced the camaraderie of a locker room. In grade school, I remember two signs posted at the entrance to the boys' locker room. "There is no I in team," and "The only difference between champ and chump is you." There was frequently music playing and raucous laughter and even singing. I was jealous. Organized sports for women were rare in the 1960s. The softball teams and field hockey teams I participated in on never involved anything as sophisticated as a locker room or even a coach. We simply just walked onto the field and started playing. I always wondered what went on in the inner sanctum of the locker room. Now I knew that cramped locker rooms are the place where team spirit is born, and team spirit has the smell of unwashed jerseys, and the sound of cinched skate laces, and the sight of unzipped equipment bags cluttering the tacky floor, and the touch of sticks tapping my pads in a show of solidarity, and our collective goal of not embarrassing ourselves. The whistle blew and off we went. But I got a sick feeling as an opponent gathered up the puck and started up the ice. I recognized her. It was that big-boned young woman with the white pants with pink piping that I spotted during warm-up. The one with sharp crossovers who made deep-seated, knuckle-cracking sounds. I imagined that she was a Canadian farm girl who had honed her power game on the backyard pond with her five older brothers. Basically, my worst nightmare. It's a hockey principle never to criticize your teammates, but frankly, my team was overmatched. My first and second lines of defense simply evaporated as our opponents deftly moved between and around them. And then it was just the two of us in a breakaway. I glided out to meet her to cut down her shooting angle and then slowly eased backwards, hoping I was still in line with the goal and hadn't drifted off to the side, leaving an open net. A couple of yards in front of me, she dropped her shoulder, leaned in, and slapped the puck. In that one instance, I realized that the fundamental skill of goalies is that they must always choose fight over flight. All logic and intuition screamed at me to get out of there and dash for safety, but based on the cozy locker room scene, I didn't want to let my teammates down. I took in a deep breath, marshaled all my willpower, and stayed put. As the puck screamed toward me, my gloved hand rose on its own volition. I felt as if I were an outsider witnessing a bravura performance orchestrated by nothing more than a brainstem. Everyone stopped play. I assumed that the puck was in the usual position in the back of the net, but when I turned, it wasn't there. The ref then skated up and plucked it out of my glove. I was astonished. My stunned teammates cheered and tapped their sticks on the ice, and even the opponents nodded in acknowledgement. I became a firm believer that instinctual hand-eye coordination on my forehand could extrapolate to hockey. Susie was right. As the game went on, there were certainly moments when I succumbed to flight. I saw Nick madly pantomiming from the bench to keep my stick on the ice, but periodically I winced, lifted my stick, and suffered the tragedy of a gaping five-hole. At the end of our 7-2 loss, my teammates came up and touched their forehead to me in grateful appreciation. After all, I had borne witness and manned my post in the face of 5 breakaways. After the game, we invited Coach Nick to join us in the scuzzy cocoon of the locker room. He had recently seen my teammates in full-on glamour mode at a community fundraiser. Now he was momentarily stunned to see them with matted hair, faces smeared with sweat, and legs splayed out as gear was removed. But Nick was totally experienced with locker room culture and settled in. After all, this is what hockey players do at the end of the game. The locker room is a barrier buster. Instead of the quiet and anxious pregame murmuring, the postgame locker room was filled with raucous recaps of bonehead plays. I described my fleeting concern that the rink was on fire when I saw smoke rising to the rink's ceiling. I looked around me a couple of times until I finally realized that the smoke was merely a plume of steam rising from my overheated head. Our defeat faded into the background. I forgot about 5 holes, cutting down angles, flopping, or standing. That wasn't the point anymore. Hockey became all about the locker room. I hadn't realized that this joyful bonding was what I'd been missing in my athletic life. Given a shortage of goalies, I was invited to join a spring league comprised of a mixture of players from different teams, each of whom had been ranked by their original teammates. The organizers sought parity, and teams supposedly included an even assortment of highly experienced college players, ranging down to inexperienced elders, such as me. This locker room smelled differently. I had rejoiced in the stale odor of the first locker room, an odor that symbolized hard work toward a common goal. But now the sour smell smacked of the individual anxiety of players who were sizing up their teammates. Who was the strongest and who was the weakest? I erupted in flop sweat when I realized I was certainly the weak link. The mantra of hockey is that defense wins playoffs. And given a choice, I don't think anyone would want the weakest player to be the goalie. Nobody tapped my pads in a show of unity as we headed out to the ice. As we warmed up, I was encouraged to see that on defense, the woman with the buzz cut and tattoos was one of the best players, and another good player was a forward. However, our opponent's best players were better than my team's best players, and I once again was faced with several breakaways. My efforts produced my usual smattering of 5-hole disasters mixed with a few athletic saves, a performance that my old team had grown to expect and appreciate. However, this team had a much loftier goal. They actually cared about winning, and I emerged as the most proximate cause of our loss. The postgame locker room was quiet and strained. Finally, the buzz-cut defensewoman sniped at the forward across the room. "You know, it's difficult to win when you're offsides all the time." The forward shot back, "Well, I wouldn't be offsides if you fed me better outlet passes." I shrank back into the bench, fearful that I would be the next target. Suddenly, the mostly naked forward leapt towards the woman with the buzz cut. The two tussled madly on the grimy floor, sticky with the sweat and detritus of dozens before them. My eyes widened. Their flailing legs had now knocked over a bench, crushing a bottle of water. Shouldn't someone intervene? If so, it certainly wasn't going to be me. My tame suburban upbringing had provided no guidance on the etiquette of a catfight. Finally, 2 other players stepped in and broke up the fight. The room sank into an electric silence. I never played hockey again. The giddy delight of being on a very steep learning curve was dissipating, and I was unwilling to put in the hard work to progress along the flattening curve. I'd have to begin to care about my save percentage and the quality of my teammates. Besides, I had more than met my goals. I had reaffirmed my athletic identity, shared a spot with my husband, and experienced an elusive locker room culture. Now my husband and I watch the Chicago Blackhawks on TV. My brief career as a human target gives me the credentials to comment on an unattended five-hole or to express awe at the agile up-and-down moves of a flopper goalie. I nod my head in recognition when a sportscaster suggests that a player is trade material because he is a cancer in the clubhouse. After all, I know exactly what they're talking about. I'm one of the few female AARP members who's been there.